The historically enduring Hispanic kingdoms were those created in the aftermath of the Muslim conquest of most of the peninsula. The 8th century reconquest that followed was an historic enterprise without parallel in human history. Elsewhere, invading forces and cultures have either been quickly repelled and eliminated, or else, as in Russia, accepted as overlords by the native population. Exotic forces, once firmly implanted, have been absorbed by or have transformed the autochthonous culture. In Hispania, invading Muslim society could not simply be defeated and rejected, and much less could it be absorbed. Yet it was not completely accepted either, and resistance by small independent groups of the indigenous population was maintained for centuries, becoming the major conditioning factor in the Hispanic cultures, until finally the Muslims had been completely defeated, subjugated, and ultimately expelled from the peninsula.
Did Spain's position in the southwest corner of Europe make it particularly susceptible to invasion from North Africa? What effect did those 8 centuries of reconquest have on Spain's identity as a nation? How important was El Cid to the retaking of Spain from the Moors? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Given its long relationship with Muslim invaders and occupiers, what was Spain's role in the Crusades? And how did it develop into a major colonial power? With us is Stanley G. Payne, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of many books on Spain, the most recent being Spain, A Unique History, to be published this fall by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
Can we go back to Spain before it got conquered by anyone? Give us some sense of where Spain begins.
Well, Spain really begins with the Romans. That is, we begin with where we have recorded history. The anthropological record, however, and the archaeological records are extensive and being studied much more in the past generation than ever before. And the Hispanic Peninsula, what is called the Iberian Peninsula, was something of a crossing ground of different peoples in prehistoric times. Celtic peoples coming from the north, the so-called Iberian peoples, native peoples who came probably from other parts of southern Europe, but also people from the white population of old northwest Africa. So one has really an extraordinary complex of different tribes and little city-states and ethnic groups in the peninsula in pre-Roman times, so complex, in fact, a configuration that one could not describe it in any simple sentence. That was the thing that made the peninsula the most difficult of all the Roman conquests in a certain sense, or at least the one that took the longest. It went on for 200 years. The Romans were not that long involved in the conquest of any other part of their enormous empire. And the reason why it took so long in the peninsula was because there was no central power. The geography is often very mountainous, very divided, very difficult to get through, and each sector of it really had to be conquered as a separate part. And so it took about 200 years.
And so what was the status of Spain by the time the Moors did become a force in Spain coming from North Africa? Was there a Spanish identity at that point?
Of a sort, although this is a very controversial issue nowadays in Spanish history. First of all, the peninsula became an integral part of the Roman Empire. It was one of the basic parts of the empire. It was not an outlier, not some marginal peripheral area, but a basic part of the empire, provided several emperors in the first and second centuries. And from the Romans, of course, the population derived their culture, their religion, their social institutions, their language. Spanish and the other language of the peninsula are all derived from Latin. Moreover, after that time, with the breakup of the empire, the new kingdom of the Visigoths, a small German group that came in and took over, established what we could probably call would be the first West European historical nation, that is, as a separate kingdom that had a very clearly defined geography that would persist eventually into modern times. But this was what we would call an historical nation, creating a very general kind of sense of identity, not at all the sort of thing involved in being a modern political nation. Because of that, when the Muslims came in 711, It was much easier for them to conquer most of the peninsula because there was a central state. Once they defeated that, it took only about 7 years, not 200 years, for them to overrun the entire peninsula.
And what made the Moors decide to go into Spain?
Well, that was what they did. After all, these were not really Moors, that is, Moroccans, although many of the troops were Moroccan. This was an extension of the original Islamic Arab Empire from the Middle East, which simply expanded in all directions osmotically as far as it could conquer. And once they had taken over Northwest Africa, the next stepping stone into Europe, obviously, was going to be the Hispanic Peninsula. They tried it out in 711, managed to win a battle and to defeat and kill the Visigothic king, and the rest was easy pickings for them.
Was this a conquest of religion, of culture, or politics, or just for colonial resources?
Well, it was, first of all, a military conquest for purposes of expansion and acquisition and booty. But, of course, what was almost unique about early Islam was, of course, the institutionalization of the jihad, the religious imperative to conquer non-Muslim territory in the interests of Islam, the argument there being ultimately for religious purposes. So all of this went together. What happened then is they took over about 90% of all the peninsula, except for the distant mountains in the far north, is that they brought their own religion and they brought their own culture. So that during the next three centuries, by about the year 1000, most of the peninsula had become not a colony of the Middle Eastern Arab world, but had become an acculturated and religiously converted part of the Muslim world, so that it really was part not of southwestern Europe, as we might think of it. It was the westernmost part of the Middle Eastern Islamic culture. It had been brought into a completely different civilization. And that was, of course, one of the most fundamental things about Spanish history.
What about resistance? When you had the Islamic forces coming in and conquering, what kind of resistance, what kind of uprising or attempt to ward them off took place?
After the Visigothic king was initially defeated and killed in 711, the resistance very fragmented, which is what made it easier then for the Muslims to take over, since it was now an organized kingdom of sorts, at least, quite different than from pre-Roman times. The only place where the native population managed to hold out was in the northern 10%, in the mountains of the far north, particularly in the northwest, and also in the corner of the northeast in the eastern Pyrenees, where the Christian population got assistance from Charlemagne and the kingdom of the Franks. So it was only the northern fringe, whereas otherwise it wasn't just a matter of the territory, as I said before, having been conquered by the Muslims. Over three centuries, it was acculturated into a different civilization, so that the eventual reconquest carried on by this initially very small minority, one of the most remarkable developments and achievements in all of world history, was not just a matter of religious conquest. They had to reacculturate and reabsorb culturally and religiously the entire territory, so that there were two sides to the subsequent reconquest. One was military, but the other was a matter of extending the new Spanish, originally North Spanish, Christian culture and religion throughout the entire peninsula, so that not merely was the territory reconquered, it was reacculturated and reconverted, if you like, religiously. And that's the sort of thing that made Spain's history absolutely unique, would have made them one of the more singular peoples in all of world history, even if they had never accomplished anything after that.
I have to ask about two populations that I think of as being geographically peripheral to this conquest. One would be the Basques in the north, in the mountains, I believe, and the other the Portuguese.
These are two very pertinent questions because, first of all, Portugal is the only part of the peninsula that became a separate country. The Basques were never a state or a separate country, but they always maintained their identity and developed certain institutions of their own. And now, of course, they've been in the last generation the ones that have caused the most trouble politically within Spain and for Spanish identity. The conditions of the reconquest were geographically and institutionally and militarily very difficult. And it was not possible to maintain any kind of unified Spanish kingdom in the northern hills. There developed several different foci of power. And eventually these were coordinated into one dynasty, one monarchy, though not one state, at the very end of the Middle Ages, as we use the term, the close of the 15th century. Portugal originally was simply one region or one small kingdom of five kingdoms in the north. What was different about Portugal was not that it really was so singular or distinct, though eventually, of course, as a separate country, it became absolutely distinct in many ways, but simply because as a result of certain political and institutional factors, it managed to sustain its independence. It really was not very different from the neighboring Spanish kingdom, the Kingdom of León, when it began in the 12th century. It was a kind of military dynastic accident that the county of Portugal became the Kingdom of Portugal, but it managed to maintain its independence, though with some difficulty later on in the 14th century, then again falling under the Spanish crown in the 16th century. But as a result of having sustained that independence, the Portuguese eventually developed a culture and an identity very unique to themselves and have been, therefore, different country and independent country ever since that time, and have really been brought together with Spain more once more only during the past generation under the European Union. The situation of the Basques is quite different. The Basque population represents the only surviving autochthonous ethnic group in the peninsula. There were lots of different autochthonous, that is, original, pristine, ethnic groups in pre-Roman and early Roman times. They were all eventually absorbed into the several kingdoms and a kind of a general Spanish people or a variety of regional peoples. The Basques were the only one who maintained their own identity. They became part of the main kingdom, the Kingdom of Castile, by the 13th century, but they were always recognized as a separate territory, not a state, but simply three different provinces. Each province had a certain set of institutions. They maintained these institutions, which were even developed by the Castilian crown, so that they had elements of self-government, limited but definite and stronger than any other regions of Spain into the early modern and modern period. And although most of this was lost in the 19th century, they did still at least preserve a separate tax system even after the last of the regional civil wars of the 19th century. They also had their own language, although most Basque people forgot it and learned Spanish. But what happened, first of all, was the development of modern industry, which came to the Basque country along with Catalonia earlier than other parts of Spain and made the Basque region socially and economically, and therefore to some extent culturally, different. And then the rise of modern European nationalism, the beginning of a nationalist movement in the Basque country, particularly at the time the Spanish began to lose confidence in themselves, around the time of the War of 1898, and then the development of the nationalist movement in the 20th century, until with the coming of democracy after 1975, with the de facto federalization of Spain and providing of regional autonomy for all the major regions, then the Basque nationalists, until very recently, have been able to dominate local affairs in the Basque country and have revived the language, even though still only a minority of the population speak it as their regular language, and have been pushing, at least until recently, for something very near to independence.
If we go back to Spain in the 700s with the Muslims coming in, I'm trying to picture how the language would work, because you've got a group in Spain that's speaking Spanish connected with Roman culture, and then you've got this Arab culture coming in with Arabic, with advances in math, astronomy. How do the two cultures somehow merge?
Well, in 711, nobody spoke Spanish. The common languages were the post-Latin, Latinate dialects in the process of becoming new languages, and they're seem to have been, according to some students of language, there have been three of them altogether, a certain form in the northwest, another form in the center, and another form in the northeast. The form in the center in the north became Castilian because of its geographical location. Coming down through the middle of the peninsula became the common language of most Spaniards, leaving only Catalan as a separate Romance language in the northeast, and then the language of the west in a separate kingdom in the southwest, Portugal, became Portuguese. They were speaking various forms of post-Latin Romance, in other words, in the 8th century. The Muslims brought in Arabic. Now, of course, the population in Al-Andalus, what one calls in Arabic, the entity known in the West as Muslim Spain, although it really wasn't Spain, it was simply the Iberian part of the Middle East, at first spoke Romance dialect, and only a minority of the people spoke Arabic. But over a period of three centuries, with the acculturation into Islamic culture, the religious conversion of the population, those that didn't want to convert simply migrated, in many cases, to the independent Christian north, there was also a linguistic conversion. So by the 11th century, when the major reconquest got underway, in fact, most of the population of Al-Andalus spoke Arabic. There were only certain enclaves that still retained Romance or that were bilingual in Arabic and Romance. So there had been a big linguistic change, but it went into reverse with the major reconquest from the 11th century on. Because then with the expansion, especially of the Kingdom of Castile, came the great expansion of the Castilian language, which became modern Spanish. It already had the form of modern Spanish as early as the 12th and 13th centuries, even before Middle English was anything like modern English, so that one has a kind of language expansion. And then ultimately, by the 15th and 16th century, the Islamic minorities that remained in Christian Spain in many cases had lost Arabic and had been re-Hispanicized into speaking Spanish. We're not able, for example, by, say, around the year 1500, to understand the Quran in the original, because they had largely lost their Arabic. This was not entirely the case. There were small Islamic populations in the southeast that still did retain Arabic, but most of the Mudéjar, or subject Muslim population, in the later Middle Ages in Christian Spain, Hispanicized linguistically as well.
We'll find out what prompted the reconquest of Spain when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Stanley Payne, who's telling us about the history of Spain, particularly in the Middle Ages. And now we're coming to this point where Spain, or at least that Iberian Peninsula, is essentially a territory, an extension of the Islamic Middle East. And now there's this push for some reason to take it back. Take it back for whom? For Christianity? For Spaniards?
Well, there has been a considerable debate about this among historians for the past century and more, because some historians take the point of view that since the northern territories were so small and weak and had not been important parts of the Visigothic Kingdom of Spain, they really couldn't have had any kind of general Spanish political or even religious identity, that they were fighting to survive and then to regain territory. And of course, up to a point, that's correct. But in fact, I think the historians are seeing more and more that the Visigoths, though with the limited circumstances of the 7th and 8th centuries, could not possibly have created a modern nation or a modern country or modern identities, had helped to develop the sense of there being a kind of Spanish entity, however one defines that identity, and that the northern population was also emphatically Christian, reinforced by succeeding waves of Christian immigrants leaving Muslim-controlled territory because they wanted to be independent Christians. It had both a political and a religious identity. And so there were many motivations for the reconquest, to regain territory, yes, but to reestablish the inheritance of the independent kingdom as much as possible, and then to re-win the peninsula for the Christian religion. These were all motivations. Now, what was the push from the other side? There has developed in modern times, ever since so roughly the middle of the 19th century, what we can call the myth of Al-Andalus. That is a set of ideas concerning the Islamic territory in the Iberian Peninsula when it was an independent emirate in covering most of the peninsula, that it was a kind of modern paradise of toleration between the three religions, the Muslims, the Christians, and the significant Jewish minority. This, of course, could not possibly have been the case because the modern Western idea of toleration didn't exist anywhere in the world, including Western Europe during the Middle Ages. But this was an idea developed by 19th century liberals and by liberal historians in Spain as well, that the ideal Spain before the Reconquest, before the Inquisition, et cetera, had really existed not under the Spanish Christians, but under the Muslims in Al-Andalus because they were so tolerant and they had a high culture. It's true they did have a high culture. By the 10th century, Al-Andalus had acculturated up to something approaching the level of cultural development of the Islamic Middle East, so that its cultural level was definitely more sophisticated, more advanced than one would find in the small and rude military Christian kingdoms of the north. And it did operate, of course, on the notion of Islamic toleration, which was not modern toleration at all, but simply the standard system in the Islamic world of discriminatory toleration. That Christians and Jews...
That sounds like an oxymoron a bit.
Well, if you want to call it, it's not toleration. It's a contradictory situation in which the minorities are allowed to practice their religion, but they don't have full what we would call in modern terms civil rights. They can't build new churches. They can't practice their religion publicly. They have to pay special taxes. They're discriminated against in all kinds of ways. And so though they are allowed to maintain their identity and religion, and they have to wear special clothing and so on. It costs them a lot of money. They're very unequal citizens, and so they pay a heavy price and penalty, but they can maintain their identity.
And these are what? This is the fate of Christians and Jews living in Moorish Spain?
This is the fate of Christians and Jews. The Jews withstood it rather better than the Christians, the Jews being a small minority with a long identity as a minority. The Christians tended to divide. Many of them moved out to the north so they could live as independent Christians. The remainder more and more tended to convert. They escaped the special taxation. They had better social and economic circumstances. They could live more nearly equal, although Al-Andalus, even for Muslims, was not a land of equal opportunity. It was always dominated in the high centuries by the Arab castes and was considerably fragmented ethnically between the Arab elite, the genuine Moors, that is, the Moroccan-Algerian minority, which was not insignificant, which was looked down upon by the Arabs, and the Christian convert majority, who came to be the majority of the Muslims, the descendants of former Christians who had converted, who were tended to be the number three category citizens. And then in addition, the remaining smaller and smaller minorities of Christians and the small Jewish minorities, a very fragmented kind of society in which there was a great deal of inter-ethnic conflict even after the great majority of the population had become Muslim. So it was not this kind of paradise, this ornament of the world, to cite the title of a book by a Spanish professor at Yale that came out 4 or 5 years ago. This is another of the modern liberal myths, but it doesn't describe the reality of Al-Andalus. And more, as the northern kingdoms got stronger and stronger militarily, and Al-Andalus began to fragment both politically and militarily, the Christian kingdoms got the upper hand. What they showed was that they were able to develop civically, politically stronger institutions than the Muslims. A weakness of Muslim society, despite its high level of cultural and economic development by the 10th and 11th centuries, was the fact that it didn't really develop what we would call in Western or modern terms political and civic institutions. It had religious institutions, it had economic and cultural institutions. Its natural political structure was simply a despotism. It was ethnically fragmented under the despotism, and after a while it simply began to break up. And the northern kingdoms, though smaller in number, at first militarily weaker, became militarily much stronger, and they more and more began to take over. But then they had to face two major invasions by the great Moroccan empires of northwest Africa that dominated Morocco and Algeria, one at the end of the 11th century, another again in the 12th century, the third, finally, in the middle of the 14th century. So these delayed the reconquest, which was not completed until the Spanish banner year of 1492, the Annus Mirabilis, with the completion of the reconquest in Granada in the southeast, the discovery of America, and also the fateful year of the expulsion of the Jews.
With the conversion that had taken place of Christians to Islam, how deep was that? In other words, was one reason that the reconquest could take place because some of those conversions were matters of convenience? If you're in a culture where you have to be heavily taxed and you're discriminated against if you don't convert, then I would think some of those conversions might have been not matters of faith, but of, you know, expediency.
That's a very pertinent question. What I would answer from what one sees in the historical record is that in the great majority of cases, by the time that the reconquest took place, in many cases not until the 13th century, these people had been Muslim for 300 or 400 years. So they were genuine converted Muslims, and the majority of them did not reconvert living under Christian rule. A large proportion of them migrated to territory that remained Muslim or even to North Africa. Now, there were sectors, for example, the Christian minority in Toledo in 1085, at the end of the 11th century, perhaps had a very special kind of identity which made it easier for them to want to, even the Muslim population there found it easier to go back under Christian rule than most Spanish Muslims. But this was not the case with the great majority. They had become genuine Muslims. And the great majority of them, even if they lived under Christian rule for several centuries, did not convert back again. So it was a conversion process that genuinely took hold.
You mentioned those waves, those counter waves from the Kingdom of Morocco, for example, one at the end of the 11th century.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like the sort of thing that would bring into play the aforementioned El Cid.
Exactly. He was the only one who could beat them because when they first came in 1086, they inflicted a terrible defeat on the King of Castile, who barely escaped from the battlefield with his life. The Cid by this time had set up his own independent state over the little Moorish Emirate of Valencia, which was small but rather wealthy. So that part of the eastern Spanish coast was a special little principality of the Cid. And he was the only person who could beat the Almoravids. He did it three different times, even though he was outnumbered on every occasion. But the unique thing about the Cid seems to have been that he was an 11th century military genius, and he never lost a battle. You could say of the Cid as a military commander kind of what some coaches used to say of Bear Bryant when he was coaching Alabama, that he was such a good coach, as one of them put it, he could take his'n and beat your'n, or he could take your'n and beat his'n. And that was the way the Cid was. No matter what the circumstances, he always found a way to win. And so even though heavily outnumbered, he beat the Almoravids three times. In the early years, he was the only Christian leader who beat the Almoravids, but he finally died, and then the Crown of Castile had to give up Valencia altogether, and that part of the frontier was rolled back for over 100 years.
Does he become something of a pan-Hispanic hero at this point? Do we see a nation beginning to coalesce under a leader like that?
The first part, I think, is the answer is yes. The second part, no, not necessarily, in that one has, by the 12th and certainly by the 13th century, that is in the generations right after the death of the Cid, developed this kind of popular poetry and even songs, what the Spanish call the Cantares de Gesta. You find this also in France, these songs of epic heroes, part of the new vernacular medieval culture. And, of course, the biggest single hero that they could find was the Cid, and so he assumed epic proportions and became very well known, the greatest folk hero in Spanish history. But in terms of the coalescence of identities, I don't know that they really played that kind of role, say, in the 13th century. But certainly he lived in popular culture like no one else did.
And what role did the Catholic Church then begin to play after this reconquest?
The Church played very much the same role in the Spanish kingdoms in the Middle Ages that it played in other parts of Western Europe. As the Spanish kingdoms developed, their institutional structure was not Islamic, as some fanciful historical commentators would like to have it. They developed the typical institutions, politically, civically, religiously, socially, institutionally, of Western Europe. So there was nothing institutionally very special about the role of the Church in the Spanish kingdoms. What was a little different, however, was the special place of the sense of religious identity in the Spanish kingdoms, because they lived on the frontier. And there was the sense that they had a kind of historical responsibility, a political and religious responsibility to hold the frontier and roll back the frontier against Islam. And this created a particular kind of religious ethos, but it did not really create any particular religious institutions or any special place for the church as an institution in Spanish society that was very different from other parts of Western Europe, because the church was, of course, a very important institution in all of Western Europe at this time. The distinct role then institutionally began to develop only to the extent that you had a national inquisition by the end of the 15th century. But the church, rather than being an especially powerful institution in the Spanish kingdoms, was largely dominated, when push came to shove, by the political power, as was the case in France, as was the case in all of these stronger European monarchies in the later Middle Ages. So that institutionally, the role and place of the church was not really different or any greater down to the 16th century than one would find elsewhere.
So did the Inquisition, the impetus for the Inquisition come from the church or from the political powers in Spain?
The impetus for the establishment of the Inquisition in 1480 came from various parts of Spanish society, from certain leaders in the church, not all the leaders in the church, from certain sectors of the political elite as well. Those were the two main elements. And the Inquisition was one of these remarkable processes of reversal in Spanish history. One of the things that makes Spain's history unique is that you have processes of reversal in the country's history that are unlike anything else to be found, at least in Western Europe, and I think even much more even in the case of a country like Russia. The reversal for the fact that it became the first sort of proto-national kingdom in the 7th and 8th centuries and then disappeared from the map virtually by the Muslim conquest. Reversal of that by the remarkable process of reconquest. And then in turn, because of the very complex frontier and religious minority situation of the populations in those kingdoms, the Spanish kingdoms were the most complex of the West European kingdoms because they were the only ones with Muslim minorities. There were no Muslims anywhere else in Western Europe except possibly in Sicily. But they had a Christian minority of considerable importance, not numerically so large, but very important economically and culturally, and that continued to be tolerated by the crowns even after the Jews had been completely expelled from the kingdoms of England and France at the beginning of the 14th century. So one finds a situation in the 14th and 15th centuries where the Spanish monarchies were the only tolerant part of Western Europe, but their form of toleration was a little like a kind of reflection of the Islamic form of toleration. It wasn't modern tolerance. It was discriminatory toleration in which certain things were expected of Jews and Muslims, which did not deprive them of their internal autonomy and their religious identity, but meant that they didn't have full and equal rights either. And by the end of the 15th century, as the main part of the peninsula was being united politically and institutionally, not really institutionally, but politically, under the dynasty, under the United Monarchy, there was more and more of a push to have a fully united country. And there was a sense among the Spanish elite that Spain was out of step because it was a religiously diverse society, unlike France and England. And that to be as strong as France and England, it had to be unified. Unified meant to be uniform, meant that the Muslims and the Jews had to be converted or expelled. And the process of conversion of the Jews at first went very well. Something like half or more of the Jewish population converted to Christianity by the middle of the 15th century. One of the largest apostasies, possibly the biggest of all, in all of Jewish history. And that was because Jewish society was so well integrated and assimilated in many ways into Spanish society. Castilian Aragonese Jews really felt like Castilian and Aragonese people. But there remained a very large minority of the Jews who would not convert. And there was the argument among the most zealous and fanatical of the religious leaders in Spain by that time that, in fact, a significant portion of the converted Jews, what were called the conversos, or the cristãos novos, new Christians in Portugal, in fact, were crypto-Judaizers. They were not real Christians. They weren't really practicing Christianity, but Judaism in secret. And the people who kept them in that game were the Jews who had not converted, ergo the conversos could not be true Christians unless the remaining Jews had been eliminated as Jews. The expectation was finally by 1492 on the part of the crown that since a large part of the Jews had converted anyway, the rest would convert and very few would have to be expelled. But in fact, the majority of those who had not been converted refused to convert. Some did further. But the majority of those who had not converted were expelled. And in the meantime, 10 years earlier, the national institution had been established to prosecute false Christians, not to prosecute Muslims, not to prosecute Jews. No regular Jew, no regular Muslim could be touched by the Inquisition. They were really going after what they conceived to be Judaizers, false Christians, primarily among the converts. And so that was the reason for this special Inquisition. This was an unusual Inquisition. Though the Inquisition had been invented under the papacy in the 13th century, it was a Roman, a papal institution, used only for certain limited territories under the church. Though the Spanish Inquisition was administered by churchmen, it was a kind of national, royal institution, a Spanish institution, though chartered by the papacy. It was not directly under church control as such. It was a special autonomous institution under the Spanish crown, which made it a very unique kind of Inquisition and a national Inquisition, something that had never existed before. It was one of the great reversals of what had seemed the natural tendency of Spanish history down to that time. Spanish history is full of these major reversals.
How ruthless was it? I mean, if you say, don't give me the Spanish Inquisition, it's come to mean generically sort of the worst treatment, the you know, torture, manipulation, putting people through very rigorous questioning, hauling them in for, you know, terrible treatment.
Yes, all these lithographs, the early lithographs of people being stretched on the rack and that sort of thing, and then being burned at the stake. And all those things occurred. There has been an enormous boom in the Inquisition history industry in the past 30 years or so. So we have a gigantic library now of Inquisition studies that 40 or 50 years back simply didn't exist. And the tendency has been to re-evaluate the Inquisition. The noted British Hispanist Henry Kamen wrote the first new history of the Inquisition in English in many decades when he was a young historian about 40 years ago, at which time he was a Marxist. He said, well, the Inquisition was really about money, and they wanted to get the money of the alleged Judaizers. He revised it 30 years later, and the new approach was to say, no, it wasn't about money at all. Inquisition? False. What Inquisition? Didn't all the states in those times practice intolerance and have their own Inquisitions? Did not Queen Elizabeth execute several hundred Catholics? Everyone had an Inquisition. Nothing unique about the Spanish Inquisition, according to Professor Kamen, the second time out, about 1990. Well, that's going too far in the other direction. The Spanish Inquisition was unique as a national institution, which after all survived for over 300 years. It was very rigorous, ruthless, even sometimes corrupt in the first decades, down to about 1520, the first 40 years. It targeted almost exclusively alleged Judaizers. It executed at least 3,000 of them, maybe 4,000. Now, when you have a converso population of perhaps well over 100,000, it's only a small minority, but it's a very large minority to be executed and to be, in many cases, burned at the stake. And altogether, they arrested maybe as many as 15 or 20,000 conversos. Now, the fact that they arrested so many, but only executed a relatively small minority of those arrested, showed that the Inquisition did have procedures of a sort. By the standards of the time, it was a fairly objective institution. It did not execute most of the people it convicted. It fined them. It condemned them to acts of public penance. It did not execute them, so it was not like a modern totalitarian institution at all. The comparison between Nazism or Stalinism, the Inquisition, very unfair to the Inquisition. The Inquisition had elaborate legal rules of evidence, and it proceeded most of the time, not in every case, according to those rules. And so about a third of the people arrested were simply let off altogether. There wasn't enough evidence against them. Of the two-thirds that were not let off, the majority were fined heavily or imprisoned or forced to do penance and were not executed. So it had its rules. It was an objective institution. Its dungeons were actually the place to be. It maintained the best prisons in Spain. So that sometimes members of the aristocracy, when they found that they had been jailed, were going to be kept in jail for a year or so, asked to be transferred to a jail of the Inquisition, because the Inquisition prisons were actually better places to be than the royal or local prisons, which were pretty nasty places in the 16th century. The use of torture was actually circumscribed. They did have those racks for stretching people on, but in fact the Inquisition used torture less than many other judicial procedures in Spain and other countries during the 16th century. So the Inquisition was partly what it was cracked up to be. It was an horrific institution for the prosecution of alleged Judaizers, particularly in the early decades, and yet it was a much more objective and in some ways limited institution than it's been made out to be. And in later years, mainly it simply prosecuted people for blaspheming and things like that, to try to maintain higher religious standards. After the first centuries, executions became more and more rare.
I guess we have Edgar Allan Poe to thank for much of the image of the Inquisition there with the pit and the pendulum, you know, being all a matter of an Inquisition punishment in action. Well, we'll see if we can get some idea of the connection between the Spanish Inquisition and the Age of Discovery when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Stanley Payne, and we are talking about the history of Spain. We have just talked about the Spanish Inquisition. Earlier, you were mentioning this miraculous year of 1492 when so much happened in Spanish history. Can you take us to that year and also talk about Ferdinand and Isabella?
Big things were happening in Spain at that point in the late 15th century. The marriage of the heiress to the crown of Castile, to the heir to the crown of Aragon, united the dynasties of the entire peninsula except for Portugal for the first time from about 1478, 1479 on. So you have a united dynasty which made it possible to prosecute the war for the completion of the reconquest, the occupation of the final Muslim redoubt around Granada in the southeastern part of the peninsula. But beyond that, the new united monarchy was arguably the most effective, the most accomplished reform government in all of Western Europe in the late 15th century. It really pulled the institutions of Castile and Aragon together. They were not united. Each kingdom maintained its separate institutions, but they were reformed, they were made more modern, more efficient, more honest, tax collections improved, the system of justice was developed much more effectively than before, the crime rate went way down, fractious noblemen were kept in hand, so they were not maintaining private armies and harassing the local population as they had sometimes done before that time, so that Spain was really on the march in 1492 with a much better, much more effective, much more efficient, and not really modern, but let's say pre-modern government than ever before, seemingly at the height of its powers with the completion of the reconquest, and it was this sort of thing which made it possible for the crown to find the money, partly from private sources, to finance the expedition of Columbus that set out just about 7 or 8 months after the completion of the reconquest of Granada.
The purpose of Columbus's voyage, I mean, obviously discover that new world out there, but was it just for booty, as you put it earlier, or was there also a component here of extending the faith?
The historians of the Spanish conquest have had a kind of saying for some generations that the trifecta, the threefold purpose of the expansion and the conquest was glory, gold, and God, whether or not necessarily in that order, and that's probably approximately correct. We know what Columbus was trying to do. He was trying to find the short route to the Far East, which simply didn't exist. So that was the immediate goal of the expedition. But he negotiated very elaborate terms with the crown of Castile, terms which held things up for months and even several years, because at the same time he wanted to have a major position of administration and power within new territories. He wanted glory and power, and he wanted also to have a cut of the loot. He wanted to have gold. But as important as anything for Columbus, and this was true for many other people as well in the expansion, was that he was a very pious Genoese Christian, and he believed that he had a divinely ordained personal mission to extend the borders of the faith and really hasten the acceleration of world history, not as we think of it nowadays, as uniting the human race by beginning to sail around the world and bringing all parts of the human society in touch with each other, but by expanding Christendom and finding a new kind of strategic outlet that would turn the border on the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which was such a severe menace for Western Europe at that time, accelerating history, making possible the reconquest of Jerusalem for Christianity, and ushering in fact, the conditions for the second coming of Christ. Columbus was a brilliant sailor in some ways, despite his false geographical notions, but he was also a religious mystic. And he played with the idea of Cristoforo, his Italian name also being in Latin Christoferens, the Christ-bearer. He was really the man who would make possible the great expansion and world historical triumph of Christianity. So all of these things were important, not merely for him, but for the crown. Queen Isabel herself, particularly, was a very pious and devout queen, and she wanted to do all of these things, as did the people who came after her.
And if you travel in Spain today, how do you see these layers of history? In other words, where you've got the Romans and all the things, the back and forth between these different groups. How do you see evidence of that, both in what you physically see and just something in the culture? What difference has it made to have this kind of very complex back and forth?
Well, it's very easy to see if you know what you're looking for, because Spain is one of the most visual countries in the world. And no place in Western Europe or the world are there more things to see in terms of ruins and historical architecture from all these various periods than in Spain. So you can see all of these layers all around you if you know where to go and the right things to look for. How do you find it nowadays in the population? That would be much harder to say. The Spanish nowadays pride themselves on being 21st century West Europeans. For the most part, they are. Their culture, their attitudes, their religious outlook for the majority of the population is not very different from that of people in other parts of Western Europe. All European countries, of course, still have their particular cultural idiosyncrasies and particularities. But Spain is now institutionally, politically, and economically a regular part of Western Europe. Socially and in terms of popular culture, it is as well. So I'm not sure that you're going to be able to go to Spain and find these strange people who really have a kind of Moorish residue, or really you'll see an evidence of crypto-Judaism maintained for centuries, things like that. They're not even really very religious for the most part nowadays. They're rather typically secular West Europeans. So in terms of pop culture, except for the historical festivals, you're not going to find it so much, but you can see it all over.
All right, so where did the bullfighting come from?
That's an interesting question. Bullfighting, in some form, was an old Mediterranean custom dating back probably at least 3,000 years. We have these paintings and various things of bulls from ancient Greece, so that doing things with bulls is an old Mediterranean custom. But even in Italy, all of this had died out by the end of the Middle Ages. It did not die out in Spain, which indicates that along with all of the changes that occurred in the peninsula over the years, the Spanish were also good at maintaining traditions, things that became archaicisms, even as early as the 16th century. So that bullfighting is an old practice. It was took place in a variety of countries 1,000 years ago. But in later times in Spain, you'd find it with popular festivals and with the strong aristocratic ethos in Spanish society. It was something done especially by aristocrats on horseback, the sort of thing you still find with the mounted bullfight in Portugal. The modern bullfight crystallized in the late 18th century. When we look at many of what are supposed to be the great traditions of Spain, we find that they're not really medieval or 16th century. They are things that crystallized in the late 18th century. For example, the various regional costumes, the styles of clothing. In the 18th century, bullfighting became the first modern commercial spectator sport. They began to build bullfight stadia, we could call them. the first modern sports arenas in Spanish towns in the 1770s and 1780s, just at the time of the independence of America. And the whole nature of the thing changed from aristocrats on horseback to plebeians on foot, but wearing special kinds of fancy costumes. If you look at the typical bullfighter costume, it's an 18th century costume with breeches, 18th century style, the traje de luces, the suit of lights. So it took that form of crystallization in the late 18th century and has changed very little since that time. But, for example, when in Rome in 1492, the Spanish Pope, Alexander VI, ordered that a Spanish bullfight be held in Rome to honor the conquest of Granada, and then in 1493, also the same thing for the discovery of America, the Romans were astonished because bullfighting as early as the 15th century had totally disappeared in Italy, not something the Romans themselves particularly did. So that already by 1500, Spanish bullfighting, at least in Christian Europe and in most of the Mediterranean, was archaic, but a tradition that the Spanish maintained, and they simply modernized in the 18th century and made it a modern spectator sport.
What sort of a colonial power did Spain make compared to, say, France and Belgium and others that, you know, because you think of all the countries, all the territory that Spain took over?
It was a different kind of colonial power than the main West European powers that came after it, because Spain was a territorial colonial power. That is, it took over large territories which were not considered colonies. The term colony never appeared in Spanish government for 250 years until the middle of the 18th century. They were considered further kingdoms under the crown of Castile, and most of the land was not made up of Spanish colonies. This is why you find a considerable difference between Spanish America and Anglo-America. Anglo-America was made up of English colonies, of English people integrally transplanted socially, politically, civically, economically, whereas what you find in territorial Spanish America was a different kind of society, basically a hybrid society, a mixed-race society of what the Spanish called mestizos, with only a very small white elite, which they called criollos or criolls, and still very large Indian populations. So it was not merely the reproduction of Spanish society in the New World, but the establishment of a new territorial societies, really new cultures, not the way that Anglo-America was transplanted English society in the New World. It was really a different kind of colonial power, much more pre-modern. That's why Anglo-America quickly became very modern. Spanish America was a different kind of thing, was more pre-modern, and had great difficulty moving into a kind of modern scheme of institutions and society and economics once these areas became independent in the 19th century.
Stanley Payne has been our guest for this action-packed hour. Thanks for guiding us through a slice of Spanish history.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Always fun. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.